In 1990, Glasgow was named European City of Culture, and no one laughed. Never before had a city's reputation undergone a more dramatic and sudden transformation, and none, as far as I'm concerned, deserves it more. Among the city's many treasures, none shines brighter, in my view, than the Burrell Collection. After checking into my hotel, I hastened there now by taxi, for it's a long way out.
Jenny, along Rinne,
said the driver as we sped along a motorway towards Pollock Park and the Burrell. I'm sorry, I said, for I don't speak Glaswegian.
Tjadak, my funny!
I hate it when this happens, when a person from Glasgow speaks to me. Yeah, I'm so sorry, I said, and floundered for an excuse. My ears are very bad. He said, which I gathered meant, I'm going to take you a very long way around and look at you a lot with these menacing eyes of mine so that you'll begin to wonder if perhaps I'm taking you to a disused warehouse where my friends are going to beat you up and take your money. But he said nothing further and delivered me to the Burrell without incident. How I like the Burrell Collection. It is named for Sir William Burrell, a Scottish shipowner, who in 1944 left the city his art collection on the understanding that it be placed in a country setting within the city boundaries. He was worried, not unreasonably, about air pollution damaging his artworks. Unable to decide what to do with this sumptuous windfall, the city council did, astonishingly, nothing. For the next 39 years, some truly exceptional works of art lay crated away in warehouses, all but forgotten. Finally, in the late 1970s, after nearly four decades of dithering, the city engaged a gifted architect named Barry Gasson, who designed a trim and restrained building noted for its airy rooms set against a woodland backdrop, and for the ingenious way architectural features from Burrell's collection, medieval doorways and lintels and the like, were incorporated into the fabric of the building. It opened in 1983 to widespread acclaim. And so, late in the afternoon, I emerged from the Burrell and into the leafy agreeability of Pollock Park in a happy frame of mind. It was a mild day, so I decided to walk back to town, even though I had no map and only the vaguest idea of where the distant center of Glasgow lay. I don't know if Glasgow is truly a wonderful city for walking or whether I've just been lucky there, but I've never wandered through it without encountering some memorable surprise. The green allure of Kelvin Grove Park, the Botanic Gardens, the fabulous Necropolis Cemetery with its ranks of ornate tombs, and so it was now. I set off hopefully down a broad avenue called St. Andrew's Drive, and found myself adrift in a handsome district of houses of substance and privilege, with a comely park with a little lake. At length I passed the Scotland Street Public School, a wonderful building with airy stairwells that I presumed was one of Mackintosh's, and soon after found myself in a seamier but no less interesting district, which I eventually concluded must be the Gorbals, and then I got lost. I could see the Clyde from time to time, but I couldn't figure out how to get to it, or more crucially, over it. I wandered along a series of back lanes, and soon found myself in one of those dead districts that consist of windowless warehouses and garage doors that say, no parking, garage in constant use. I took a series of turns that seemed to lead ever further away from society, before finally bumbling into a short street that had a pub on the corner. Fancying a drink and a sit-down, I wandered inside. It was a dark place, and battered, and there were only two other customers, a pair of larcenous-looking men sitting side by side at the bar, drinking in silence. There was no one behind the bar. I took a stance at the far end of the counter and waited for a bit, but no one came. I drummed my fingers on the counter and puffed my cheeks and made assorted puckery shapes with my lips, the way you do when you're waiting. And just why do we do that, do you suppose? It isn't even privately entertaining in the extremely low-level way that, say, peeling a blister or cleaning your fingernails with a thumbnail is. I cleaned my nails with a thumbnail and puffed my cheeks some more, but still no one came. Eventually, I noticed one of the men at the bar, eyeing me.
Hey, whoop my duke,
he said. I'm sorry, I replied.
Hell nebe, I do not mooning.
He hoiked his head in the direction of a back room. Oh, I said, and nodded sagely, as if that explained it. I noticed that they were both still looking at me.
Yeah, I'm a pill.
I'm sorry? He repeated. It appeared that he was a trifle intoxicated. I gave a small apologetic smile and explained that I came from the English-speaking world.
Yeah, Krun, the Krun and Jin,
said his mate, and added,
we are spoon.
Oh! Ah! I nodded thoughtfully again, pushing my lower lip out slightly, as if that was all very clear to me now. Thank you. Just then, to my small relief, the barman appeared, looking unhappy and wiping his hands on a tea towel. He said to the two men, and then to me in a weary voice, I couldn't tell if it was a question or a statement. A pint of tenants, please, I said hopefully. He made an impatient noise as if I were avoiding his question. I'm sorry. Said the first customer, who apparently saw himself as my interpreter. I stood for some moments with my mouth open, trying to imagine what they were saying to me, wondering what mad impulse had bidden me to enter a pub in a district like this, and said in a quiet voice, just a pint of tenants, I think. The barman sighed heavily and got me a pint. A minute later, I realized what they were trying to say to me was that this was the worst pub in the world in which to order lager, since all I would get was a glass of warm soap suds dispensed from a gasping, reluctant tap, and that really I should flee with my life while I could. I drank two sips of this interesting concoction, and, making as if I were going to the gents, slipped out a side door. It was time for me to rebond with my family and end my valedictory tour of this small island. I suppose everybody has a piece of landscape somewhere that he finds captivating beyond words, and mine is the Yorkshire Dales. I can't altogether account for it, because you can easily find more dramatic landscapes elsewhere, even in Britain. All I can say is that the Dales seized me like a helpless infatuation when I first saw them, and will not let me go. Partly, I suppose, it is the exhilarating contrast between the high fells, with their endless views, and the relative lushness of the valley floors, with their clustered villages and green farms. To drive almost anywhere in the Dales is to make a constant transition between these two hypnotic zones. It is wonderful beyond words. And partly, it's the snug air of self-containment that the enclosing hills give, a sense that the rest of the world is far away and unnecessary, which is something you come to appreciate very much when you live there. Every dale is a little world of its own, to an extraordinary degree. I remember one sunny afternoon, when we were new to our dale, a car overturned in the road outside our gate with a frightful bang and a noise of scraping metal. The driver, it turned out, had clipped a grass bank and run up against a field wall which had flipped the car onto its roof. I rushed out to find a local woman hanging upside down by her seatbelt, bleeding gently from a scalp wound and muttering dazed sentiments along the lines of having to get to the dentist and that this wouldn't do at all. While I was hopping around and making hyperventilating noises, two farmers arrived in a Land Rover and climbed out. They gently hauled the lady from the car and sat her down on a rock. Then they righted the car and maneuvered it out of the way, while one of them led the lady off to have a cup of tea and get her head seen to by his wife. The other scattered sawdust on an oil slick, directed traffic for a minute till the road was clear, then winked at me, climbed into his Land Rover, and drove off. The whole thing was over in less than 5 minutes, and never involved the police or ambulance services or even a doctor. An hour or so later, someone came along with a tractor and hauled the car away, and it was as if it had never happened. They do things differently in the Dales, you see. For one thing, people who know you come right into your house. Sometimes they knock once and shout, "Hello!" before sticking their head in, but often they don't even do that. It's an unusual experience to be standing at the kitchen sink, talking to yourself animatedly and doing lavish raised-leg farts, and then turning around to find a fresh pile of mail lying on the kitchen table. And I can't tell you the number of times I've had to dart into the pantry in my underpants at the sound of someone's approach and cowered breathless while they've shouted, "Hello! Hello! Anyone's home?" For a couple of minutes you can hear them clumping around in the kitchen, examining the messages on the fridge and holding the mail to the light. And then they come over to the pantry door and in a quiet voice they say, "Just taking 6 eggs, Bill, all right." When we announced to friends and colleagues in London that we were moving to a village in Yorkshire, a surprising number of people made a sour face and said, "Yorkshire? What, with Yorkshire people? How very, interesting." Or words to that effect. I've never understood why Yorkshire people have this terrible reputation for being mean-spirited and uncharitable. I've always found them to be decent and open, and if you want to know your shortcomings, you won't find more helpful people anywhere. It's true that they don't exactly smother you with affection, which takes a little getting used to if you hail from a more gregarious part of the world, like anywhere else. Where I come from in the American Midwest, if you move into a village or a little town, everybody comes to your house to welcome you like this is the happiest day in the history of the community. And everyone brings you a pie. You get apple pies and cherry pies and chocolate cream pies. There are people in the Midwest who move house every 6 months just to get the pies. In Yorkshire, this would never happen, but gradually, little by little, they find a corner for you in their hearts and begin to acknowledge you when they drive past, with what I call the Malhamdale wave. This is an exciting day in the life of any new arrival. To make the Malhamdale wave, pretend for a moment that you're grasping a steering wheel. Now, very slowly extend the index finger of your right hand as if you were having a small, involuntary spasm. That's it. Doesn't look like much, but it speaks volumes, believe me, and I shall miss it very much. I lost myself in a little reverie along these lines, and then, with a start, I realized I was pulling into the station, and my wife was waving to me from the platform. Suddenly, my trip was over. I hastened from the train in a state of confusion, like someone wakened in the middle of the night by an emergency, and felt as if this was somehow not the right termination at all. This was all too abrupt. We drove home over the tops, a winding 6 mile drive of unutterable loveliness, up onto the Wuthering Heights like expanses around Kirkby Fell, with boundless views of northern glory, and then began the descent into the serene, cupped majesty of Malhamdale, the little lost world that had been my home for 7 years. Halfway down, I had my wife stop the car by a field gate. My favorite view in the world is there, and I got out to have a look. You can almost see the whole of Malhamdale, sheltered and snug beneath steep, imposing hills, with its arrow-straight, dry-stone walls, climbing up impossibly ambitious slopes, its clustered hamlets, its wonderful little two-room schoolhouse, the old church with its sycamores and tumbling tombstones, the roof of my local pub, and in the center of it all, obscured by trees, our old stone house, which is far older itself than my native land. It looked so peaceful and wonderful that I could almost have cried, and yet it was only a tiny part of this small enchanted island. Suddenly, in the space of a moment, I realized what it was that I loved about Britain, which is to say, all of it. Every last bit of it, good and bad. Marmite, village fetes, country lanes, people saying, "Mustn't grumble," and "I'm terribly sorry, but..." People apologizing to me when I conk them with a careless elbow. Milk in bottles, beans on toast, haymaking in June, stinging nettles, seaside piers, ordnance survey maps, crumpets, hot water bottles as a necessity, drizzly Sundays, every bit of it. What a wondrous place this was. Crazy, of course, but adorable to the tiniest degree. What other country, after all, could possibly have come up with place names like Tooting Beck and Farley Wallop, or a game like cricket that goes on for 3 days and never seems to start? Who else would think it not the least odd to make their judges wear little mops on their heads, compel the Speaker of the House of Commons to sit on something called the Woolsack, or take pride in a military hero whose dying wish was to be kissed by a fellow named Hardy?
"Please, Hardy, full on the lips with just a bit of tongue."
The fact is that this is still the best place in the world for most things. To post a letter, go for a walk, watch television, buy a book, venture out for a drink, go to a museum, use the bank, get lost, seek help, or stand on a hillside and take in a view. All of this came to me in the space of a lingering moment. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I like it here. I like it more than I can tell you. And then, I turned from the gate and got in the car. I knew without doubt that I would be back.